privileges and rights at the intersections of environmental literature, history, and cultural studies, with a particular focus on relations among sexual, ecological, and corporeal politics. Her upcoming monograph is titled This Is For You, Walks with Jane Rule on Queer Literary and Public Cultures in Canada. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Sennelands.
Thank you very much, Mac, and thank you, Jorge, for inviting me. Thank you, Marilyn, for doing everything to get me here, and especially helping me sort through the huge stacks of forms that seem to accompany any cross-border voyage between Canada and the U.S. these days. Just as a complete footnote, unrelated footnote, because I will otherwise forget to mention Jane Rule, the subject of my current work, about whom I will not be speaking today, although she is most strongly associated with her writing from Galliano Island, which is the part that I'm writing about, is originally from Plainfield. In the midst of Rob's really quite wonderful presentation, I had a sick feeling in the pit of my stomach that choosing to start with pop culture after that gravitas might not have been the best possible idea. However, it's too late now. In July 2003, a so-called reality TV series premiered on the Bravo TV network called Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. Originally premised on the idea that heterosexual men are hopelessly inept in the pursuit of anything like aesthetic intelligence, each show in the series revolved around the intervention of five gay men, a food and wine connoisseur, a personal grooming specialist, an interior designer, a fashion consultant, and an expert on social interactions and relationships, into the life and lifestyle of some well-meaning straight male slob, in order to prepare him for some major life event, whether it be a gathering of his extended family for a barbecue or a marriage proposal to his presumably more fashion-savvy fiancée. All the queers in the audience are nodding their heads because they've all seen this show. The format of the show is familiar to anyone who's ever watched a makeover program. Experts, in this case are gay SUV-driving Fab Five, evaluate and judge extremely negatively the personal tastes, habits, living quarters, relationship skills, and here often body odor, of the subject for whom the aesthetic intervention is to take place. Our experts then educate him about the wide world of shopping possibilities that are out there for the knowledgeably elite, in this case gay male consumer. Decorative, grooming, etiquette, culinary, and fashion choices are foisted upon him whether he likes it or not. And at the end of each show, the experts watch and comment on a live-action feed of our straight guy and his state of newly awakened aesthetic competence at said family or romantic event. Did he get it? Is the world now safe from his past grooming relationship and decorating faux pas? Is the line between aesthetic and familial harmony now firmly established, guaranteeing our straight guy future heterosexual bliss? Is he now at last fully enmeshed in a consumer sensibility that is appropriately intelligible to his mother and especially to his fiancée? Queer Eye is an interesting text with which to begin this musing on unthinking heteronaturativity, largely because, despite its title, there's nothing very queer about it. To be sure, the show invokes and plays with the fab stereotype of urbane queer connoisseurship, what Judith Halberstam would call metronormativity, toward a rethinking of aesthetics in a generally queer direction, a project in which I would like us to engage today as part of our queer ecological project. Queer Eye, however, actually invokes the queer toward an end of unqueering aesthetics, of showing that the queer eye is really just a set of stylistic commodities that are available, with a little consumer education, to absolutely everyone, and with very little accommodation involved of the kinds of perverse performative excess with which queer aesthetics have been otherwise productively tied by the likes of Judith Butler. In fact, although the sexual identity of our aesthetic experts is supposedly heralded in the show's title, for the most part, it's not so easy to tell that they're gay. They dress quite conservatively, no drag queens here, although the fashion guy is a bit gayer than the others, and thus dresses a bit more flamboyantly. There is a bare minimum of campy repartee among the Fab Five. There is only very understated flirtation between the gay and straight men on the show. The slightly gayer one can be counted upon for most of the sexual innuendo. And there's absolutely no indication that any of the five have relationships with one another outside the show. In other words, outside their relations to the subject around whom the show's narrative is organized. The queer eye on the show only exists for the straight guy. Queer is here evacuated of any residual cultural excess, any gender or erotic transgression, any bodies other than straight ones who might actually have or desire sex, any sense of queer community, and most oddly, any real queer challenge to conventional aesthetics, as the personal and household results of the Fab Five's interventions are generally pretty boring. At the end of the day, then, what we have is a not-so-very queer eye after all. Five men, all but one of whom would probably pass as straight, spend each show making the world safer for consumer capitalism and heterosexual relationships, all wrapped up in a kind of aesthetic conservatism generally associated with middle-class notions of good taste, understatement, and moderation. The figure of the queer is invoked here to give a slightly liberal edge to what is actually a very straight commodity indeed. As something of a late-night home reno show junkie, and you're welcome to interrogate me on that later on, I found something a bit more interesting than queer eye to orient the kind of critical queer sensibility I'd like us to pursue here. Entitled Colin and Justin's Home Heist, the criminality of the title alone is indicative of something more interesting. This show, by way of contrast, really does something to bring out the queer in queer eye. Home Heist is every bit as much a makeover show as Queer Eye, premiered on Canada's Home and Garden television network, HGTV, in 2007. It maintains the convention of the aesthetic intervention with all of its consumer-driven intentions. But there the similarity ends. Colin McAllister and Justin Ryan, a married couple from Glasgow who also maintain a residence in Toronto, are most definitely gay, and they most certainly camp it up. They flirt, bicker, have hissy fits with each other, with the tradespeople who are required to carry out the couple's always elaborate plans, and with the grandmother's newlyweds and divorcees who are their targets. Colin and Justin are not so interested in cultivating good taste and personal hygiene. Instead, they authoritatively impose their often outrageous taste on skeptical and sometimes overtly resistant homeowners, and we, the audience, are quite excited by the resulting displays of resistance and dominance. The premise of the show, modeled on their previous British success, How Not to Decorate, is that the blandness, misery, and tackiness of the household world needs to be obliterated in the service of an abundant and an enthusiastic aesthetic excess. Because bad design, says their website, because bad design Canada is a sin. Although Colin is often understated, Justin routinely sports ever more enormous and outrageous corsages, large sunflowers and colorful tree branches among them. And they both delight in the production of dining rooms and bedrooms that combine multi-textured wallpapers, busily contrasting fabrics, bright paints of the sort against which all real estate agents warn sternly, and furniture ranging from modernist black leather recliners to prissy Louis Kahn's knockoffs, all in the same room. Colin and Justin love the drama. One episode, for example, has them extolling the virtues of an entirely pink household to a deeply worried middle-aged lesbian couple whose horror-stricken expressions as Justin unfolds a filmy banner of fuchsia drapery fabric draw the viewer into an interesting aesthetic position. We love Colin and Justin, but how on earth are we going to accept all of that pink? They even make them wear pink satin shirts. The result of the intervention is, again, in contrast to Queer Eye, not at all tasteful in the sense to which we might be accustomed as HGTV viewers. It's loud. But it works. Perhaps most viewers could not imagine living in a completely pink household, but it would be hard for even the most conservative viewer to opine that the result of the intervention is not somehow oddly pleasing. Rather than bend the queer eye to an existent aesthetic, then, Colin and Justin manage, through their overtly queer identification, relationship, campy and sometimes outrageous rituals, and probably hyper-developed design skills, to produce interiors that actually challenge bourgeois assumptions about taste, color, texture, utility, and what it means to be pleased in and by an interior. The point of this comparison is not to hold up Colin and Justin as queer gurus who are able somehow to direct us to a post-heteronormative, post-capitalist sensibility in which a queer eye orients a thoroughly transgressive set of aesthetic political possibilities to take to eco-critical practice and queer revolution. That would be a bit much to ask of HGTV. Rather, what we can see in Colin and Justin, perhaps more modestly, is a desire quite literally to redecorate the world according to a palette that quite simply doesn't conform to ordinary notions of good taste, and that makes canny use of queer, relational, aesthetic, affective, and sexual possibilities to imagine a different kind of pleasing every day. Queer Eye for the Straight Guy is a brilliant example of what Lisa Duggan has called homonormativity, the assimilation of heterosexual assumptions and ideals into LGBTIQ culture and identity. Indeed, in this case, the deployment of a queer veneer to legitimate and even naturalize that assimilatory move. Colin and Justin move the other way, insisting on an aesthetic that is not afraid to take the camp and the excessive, the queer innuendo and the effeminate corsage, even the public invocation of queer sex and queer community, to the task of reorienting our judgments about the good, the beautiful, and the possible. I'd like to argue here that recent trends toward thinking eco-criticism and or environmental politics in a queer ecological register should pay serious attention to this idea that queer is both a description of the more than human world and also an attitude and orientation through which to politicize that world, its apprehension and constitution in and for public culture, a radical epistemology. In my view, queer in ecology requires an invocation of precisely the kind of excessive, transgressive, and sexualized aesthetic desire we see not only in Colin and Justin, but in a proliferating range of queer cultural interventions. Therefore, I propose that an eco-critical project of unthinking heteronaturativity must necessarily have affinities to recent constellations of queer critical practice intent on disrupting and disorienting a whole range of everyday and institutional heteronormativities. The end goal of such a critical intervention is not the achievement of a more inclusive view of the world in which I can be natural too, but instead the radical unsettling question from a place of queer cultural practice and sexual desire of heteronormativity itself in order to open up new possibilities for sexual, aesthetic, and here, ecological experience. What I'd like to do here today is two things. First, I'd like to compare two nodes of thinking that seem to be emerging in recent literatures on queer ecology in order to specify my need for a queerer eco-critical eye. The first note is broadly concerned with the exploration of queer nature, with the consequences to our views necessarily of both the natural world and of humanity of such fundamental ontological realizations as the extraordinary diversity of sexual activities and gender possibilities in non-human species, the dynamics of relationality and evolutionary processes, and the co-constitutive eroticism of organismic interrelationships. More or less post-humanist in their origins and implications, these realizations share a common agenda of reorienting the naturalness of nature to broadly queer ends. They pick apart the tight ball of relations wrapped around the equation of human heterosexual reproduction and identity with natural process and normal development. What happens to heteronaturativity, one is forced to ask, when it is revealed to have no clothes and not much in the way of cellular autonomy either? The second note is also broadly concerned more with matters of queer sensibility, with the ways in which experiences of the natural world, lived and organized as somehow queer, offer a potential challenge not only to the heteronormative readings of sex and nature with which we are accustomed in much eco-critical work, but more broadly, to the political appearance of ecology and environmentalism in specific forms. Embedded, for example, in the experiences of various queer identities, communities, publics, and erotic practices, or consciously produced in queer cultures and texts, these queerings of nature suggest matters of position, perspective, and especially orientation. Here, one finds investigations of what it looks and feels like to live against the heteronatural grain. What new forms of affinity, temporality, mobility, spatiality, and sexuality are opened up in a queer experiencing of the world? And how are our transgressive, excessive, abject, and/or suspect desires potentially revelatory of new ways, not only of decorating, but of living among these complicated networks of Earth inhabitants? These two modes of unthinking heteronaturativity are, to be sure, related and mutually dependent. One could argue that they're flip sides of the same coin. The former demands a rethinking of what it means to be queer when the modes of naturalization in which sexuality is enmeshed are questioned. The latter demands, in many ways, exactly the reverse, a re-experiencing of nature from a place of deliberate query and cultural reorientation. But I would like briefly, at the end of the paper, to emphasize the singular political importance of the latter, and hence the enormous value of a queer eye for and in environmental literature. Working through Shani Mutu's 1996 novel, Sirius Blooms at Night, my argument is that the queerly embodied sexual and ecological relations enacted in the novel, by virtue of their unsettling and occasionally disgusting sensuousness, offer quite a disorienting experience of something like a queer eco-aesthetics, one that dislodges heteronatural complacence, that opens up excessive possibilities for both pleasure and unpleasure, and that therefore also opens space for a broader political conversation about the configuration of sex, nature, and pleasure in ecological discourse. Like Colin and Justin's All Pink Palace, Mutu's nature is way too much. But that excess turns out to be an effective challenge to the neat hetero-bourgeois nature ideals in which much eco-critical desire is currently mired. It is thus, I hope, a particularly queer eye with which to conclude. I move first to something like a descriptive enumeration of my two contrasting points in the spectrum of literatures in the growing field of queer ecology. The first node centers on the idea that queer nature is an ontological condition. Here, Canadian science studies scholar Myra Hurd has written quite prolifically about queer and trans natures, in the process documenting a staggering diversity of sexual forms, gendered embodiments, and reproductive possibilities in non-human animals and other organisms. In the process of enumerating this diversity, she affirms, following the lead of biologists Bruce Bagamale and Joan Roughgarden, that same-sex eroticism is most certainly natural, if by natural we mean biologically ubiquitous. Homosexual behavior, she writes, occurs in over 450 different species of animals, is found in every geographic region of the world, in every major animal group, in all age groups, and with equal frequency amongst males and females. Moreover, she argues that stable sexual dimorphism is far from the only possibility for gendered embodiment out there. Intersexuality is common in species far too numerous to document. Many organisms move from one kind of sexed body to another under different environmental conditions, at different points in their lifespans, and in relation to the gender of other members of the species. And still other organisms take on specific behaviors or characteristics of other genders in order to fool predators, attract sexual partners, or simply impress the social competition. What is interesting about this apparent polymorphous perversity and the trans possibility it also offers is not only the fact of sexual and gender diversity itself in nature, it's also the ways in which biological queerness and what she calls animal trans call into question so many of the arguments about authenticity, embodiment, identity, and even technology on which more conventionally human-centered arguments about sexuality currently rest. For Hurd, in other words, queer nature opens an important door to post-humanist argument. Sex and gender comprise yet another realm in which human behavior is revealed to be not so very unique after all, and the line between nature and artifice drawn in both heteronormative and some LGBTIQ readings of sexual identity, culture, and politics is revealed to be ultimately unsupportable, along with any exceptionality for human sexual activities and desires. As Elizabeth Wilson adds, referring to the complex intersex and multi-partner life of many of the species of barnacle that were the subject of Darwin's studies, to think of non-human animals as queer in conventional terms is thus too glib. The point for Wilson is not to impose identitarian or other human sex gender order onto the natural world in order to assimilate non-human diversity to existent categories of sex and gender. Rather, the characterization of barnacles and others as queer, and I quote, has much more punch if it is used contrariwise to render those familiar human, cultural, and social forms more curious as a result of their affiliation with barnacle organization. The queerness of Darwin's barnacles is salutary, not because it renders the barnacle knowable through its association with familiar human forms, but because it renders the human, cultural, and social guises of queer less familiar and more captivated by natural and biological forces. In other words, much as we must take caution from the varied history of uses to which so-called queer nature has been put, see in particular the work of Stacey Alimo and Jennifer Terry, including both the naturalization and the bestialization of same-sex sex, the glorious strangeness of ecosexual diversity also has the potential to open human queer to new possibilities. This same broadly post-human and quite exuberant reading of queer nature can be seen in recent work by Timothy Morton. In his 2010 PMLA article, Queer Ecology, for example, he points to several affinities between queer theory and, say, non-essentialist biology, including their shared emphasis on relationality and porous fluid identities, and also their shared troubling of firm categorical distinctions between life and non-life. Like Hurd, Morton argues that nature's pretty queer, not only because of non-human sex and gender diversity, but also because of the queer possibilities involved in evolution as a whole, understood here as a non-teleological emergence of life forms from and within other life forms. My favorite part of this article concerns Morton's unlikely, possibly unholy coupling of Richard Dawkins with Judith Butler on the issue of gender performativity in evolutionary biology. He writes, "Gender as performance is underpinned by evolutionary satisficing." That term is actually from decision-making theory. It's an amalgam of satisfy and suffice. To return to the quote, "If your kind of body works, you can keep it." This conception accords with Butler's view of performativity as regulated sets of iterated functions that act as constraints. To this extent, DNA itself is performative. Put differently, species become themselves differently over and over again through this process of evolutionary satisficing, in which they take on a mode of being only in relation to the demands of their environments, including relations of signification with others. Rather like a drag queen at the literal performance of her life, an anteater produces itself for an ant long enough to satisfy the ant and its environment more broadly, that the anteater is what it is, and vice versa from the perspective of the ant. Its being is thus not internal and essential, but constituted sufficiently, perhaps ecologically interpolated, if we're going to use Butler's language, in and for particular species interactions over the course of evolutionary time. In Morton's words, then, rabbits are deconstructive all the way down. Signifying and display happen at every level, and queer ecology would thus go to the end and show how beings exist precisely because they are nothing but relationality, deep down for the love of matter. Like Hurd, but more so, Morton takes a position in which nature, or what he actually calls the mesh, offers up to the aware participant an almost unimaginably open-ended series of possibilities for non-essentialist interrelationships between and among organisms and non-organisms. In this sense, his nature is queerer than Hurd's, but they still share a clear desire to rethink what current humanities and social science researchers mean by queer in light of the glorious strangeness revealed in evolutionary thought from Darwin on down. One thing that Morton adds is the sense that queer literary forms might be more promising than most masculinist nature writing for capturing this mesh. Still, however, in his work as well as Hurd's, queer nature is a matter more of being than perspective, as in his view, quote, "fully and properly, ecology is queer theory, and queer theory is ecology." The final queer nature in this constellation concerns the question of queer eroticism, and more precisely, the anti-heteronormative focus some thinkers have developed with the idea that beings become or are co-constituted through diverse forms of sexual interaction. Both Hurd and Morton actually consider the question of erotic co-constitution, Morton more in passing through the language of intimacy and symbiosis, and Heard more specifically through a rendering of Deleuze and Guattari's notion of becoming. In their example of the wasp and the orchid, she notes, the sexual encounter, that is, pollination, enacts a relational co-implication of the one with the other. By pollinating the orchid, the wasp becomes part of its reproductive apparatus, which at the same time becomes a piece of the wasp. Or what Deleuze and Guattari would call a becoming orchid of the wasp and a becoming wasp of the orchid. In addition, Heard also points to microbiologist Lynn Margulis' assertion that, quote, new tissues, organs, and species evolved primarily through long-lasting relationships between different species, a radical challenge to textbook accounts of competition, individualism, and selfish genes. Sex, as an especially interesting set of interagential encounters, suggests particular symbiogenetic fecundity for new bodies and modes of embodiment through diverse kinds of encounters of becoming. Patricia McCormack considers these issues from a slightly different perspective. In the context of an extended discussion of the intersections between queer and post-human challenges to the primacy of the heteromasculine I at the center of Western humanism, she takes aim at the Oedipal drama that establishes that I, that individualized self, as a subject who desires in the midst of a world of objects. She argues that as queer encourages sexual selves to create relations with objects of desire, which challenge and deterritorialize the self, becomings use non-human terms to encourage these deterritorializations. Briefly, McCormack proposes, along with corporeal feminists such as your own Elizabeth Gross, that queer desire is not generated by a desiring subject who then seeks gratification in the world. Instead, deterritorialized desire is generated in the encounter itself, in which, according to Gross, erotogenic surfaces induce in their touchings an intensification of excitement in the other that constitutes desire as a relational zone rather than a dialectical encounter between individuals. Desire literally becomes flesh. Multiple encounters disrupt and displace the subject in the transformative and widely distributed process of touching. Similar to Heard and Morton, but with an emphasis on phenomenological rather than evolutionary modes of becoming. McCormack emphasizes here that a post-human and anti-essentialist view of sexuality has extraordinary resonances with queer desire and queer theory, and especially with queer and perverse challenges to the linkage of sexual desire with heteromasculine subjectivity in modern Western discourses of identity and selfhood and, one might add, wilderness right. In this broad grouping of queer natures, we can see, I hope, a common dynamic. All three indicate ways in which contemporary queer theory may find strange, wonderful, and expanding resonances in the exploration of post-humanist possibility, in the fact that nature may be queerer than we could have possibly imagined, and in the fact that anti-heteronormative struggles may share with science studies, and Deleuze, maybe, a commitment to opening up the ontological universe of sex and gender to more thoroughly queer readings that transgress not only sexual, but species and corporeal lines toward a more relational and anti-essentialist view of self, organism, evolution, and ecology. Queer nature indicates the non-exceptionality of human sexual behavior. It also suggests that many of the ways in which we have thought about queer so far in the world of queer theory are quite limited by anthropocentric and humanist assumptions. It's hard not to love this cluster of work for its almost celebratory announcement of the ubiquity of the strange, the generative agency of the polymorphously perverse, even the ultimately rather banal reach of the queer into bacterial as well as human cultures. Heard, Morton, and McCormack, among others, offer a valuable articulation of post-humanism with queer ecology that appropriately demands we extend our understanding and perception of queer nature to resituate the familiar dramas of human sexuality and the immensely more interesting context of which it was always already part. This view is humbling, disorienting, and challenging. What does it mean to think about sex from the perspective of a barnacle? What happens to modern accounts of sexual identity, orientation, and community in the midst of the knowledge, for example, that we may all be much queerer than we'd ever thought, becoming the sex organ of a tree as we move seeds around on the clumps of dirt on our hiking boots in our so-called primordial encounters with wilderness. But I don't think it's enough. Although there's no question that we need better biology and fuller accounts of queer, more interesting sex all around. I find myself wondering, if everything is queer, then is anything really queer? In what political and social context are knowledges about queer nature generated? And how do these knowledges in turn generate ideas about the relationship between, say, sexual nature and sexual culture? What happens to the rather textured and interesting history of the queer in sociocultural relations if our focus becomes as truly wide as these thinkers seem to be advocating? What happens to the specific experiences of human social actors who live with the consequences of queer that are not always as ludic as the ones I have thus far presented? What happens to the material reality of queer and queering experiences of subjection and resistance of heteronormativity and its internalization and its transgression, especially if we might be interested in the creative or critical possibilities of queer nature and ecology? Where, in other words, is the overtly political challenge that the term queer should add to ecology by invoking the ways in which differently positioned and lived experiences might reshape ecological thought? In response to this raising of queer as a more obviously political position, there is thus a second mode of thinking in queer ecology that I find at least equally important to our project. Beginning with the experiences of individuals and collectivities designated as queer in contemporary Western categorical universes, these works assert that it is every bit as important to queer ecology from embodied historical experience as it is to reconceive it from a position of expanded biological understanding. Perhaps more anthropocentric than the other queer ecologies I've discussed, fair criticism. In this constellation of thought, issues of culture, power, and knowledge and embodied resistance are, however, more thoroughly foregrounded. Here we may follow in the wakes of the likes of Halberstam, Lauren Berlant and Michael Warner, and Sarah Ahmed, all of whom seek, in Halberstam's words, to examine the political and critical possibilities of alternative epistemologies, and particularly the modes of knowledge production associated with queer modes of being. Where Halberstam explores queer challenges to heteronormative configurations of space and time, where Berlant and Warner investigate the changed possibilities of identity, intelligibility, publics, culture, and sex that appear when the heterosexual couple is no longer the referent or privileged example of sexual culture, and where Ahmed posits queer desire as a sort of slantwise relation to a world oriented in and by the straight lines and lineages of compulsory heterosexuality. Thinkers such as Rachel Stein, Jill Anderson, and Bruce Erickson propose that there are queer histories and experiences of nature cultures that give rise to differently located, differently oriented, differently enabled, even differently intelligible ecologies to the ones we are accustomed to seeing, desiring, and imagining. This orientation in queer ecology, if you will, emphasizes the critical possibilities potentially emerging from alternative, slantwise responses to heteronaturativity and its multiple institutions. It is absolutely not transgression for the sake of transgression, a stance I would simply call bad theory, queer or not. The cultivation of modes of ecological knowledge in relation to queer modes of being is instead, in these works, of great importance. One of the thinkers most strongly associated with this position is Stein, who's been instrumental in developing conversations both within and outside eco-critical circles about the relations between sexual politics and environmental justice. She's been especially concerned with the social relations and knowledges through which queers have been positioned as against nature, and thus also with the political responses, most prominently in her work of lesbians, to the ideas of nature informing environmentalist thought as it is a clear part of a network of heteronatural practices that criminalize queer sex and queer culture. She writes, "Divergent sexual identities and practices have historically been condemned and punished as unnatural expressions of desire. by analyzing how discourses of nature have been used to enforce heteronormativity, to police sexuality, and to punish and exclude those who have been deemed sexually transgressive, we can begin to understand the deep underlying commonalities between struggles against sexual oppression and other struggles for environmental justice. For Stein, there is no possibility of a neutral view of more than human nature. The positing of a universal environment in which all subjects are to share the same concern for capital N nature obscures the basic fact that power relations of racism, colonialism, sexism, and heterosexism organize individual and collective experiences of the more than human world. Without recognition of the situatedness of any and all experiences and stories of nature cultures, heteromasculine conceptions of an innocent and external nature, as if it were able to be devoid of political practice, will continue to mask and legitimate the expulsion of queers from the garden, the naturalization of heteronormativity, and the criminalization of queer possibility in the name of natural law and eco-moral hygiene. It will also do little to challenge the embedded conditions of the environmental devastation in which they are all located. Queer environmental justice epistemologies then begin from the slantwise, denaturalized perceptions of LGBTIQ and two-spirit individuals and collectivities, and develop situated public reflections on the conditions and meanings of the natural world, with which especially to consider questions of coalition and affinity. How here does a queer ecological politics contribute to the production of conditions in which queer flourishing is allied with other ecological possibilities? With a similar logic, but in a very different direction, two other recent works also begin from a deep commitment to a politicized queer epistemology. As Stein begins by interrogating what it means to live a life against nature, Anderson and Erickson both inquire in different ways into how one lives a life with no future. As Lee Edelman has argued quite famously, and as Halberstam has also explored, queer sexualities and ways of life call into question the naturalness of reproduction, and with it, the institutions, practices, and ethics of temporality and futurity that accompany hegemonic coupling, mating, and child-rearing. Heteronaturalization here works to craft particular notions of time, space, and life as natural insofar as all circulate around the raising of offspring, both as personal practice and as societal goal. For Edelman and Halberstam, then, there are profound ethical and political questions associated with the disruptions of both family time and the time of inheritance that organize and naturalize reproductivity, meaning not only the daily rituals of childbearing and rearing, but also generational time within which values, wealth, goods, and morals are passed through family ties from one generation to the next. Heteronaturativity is here temporally always already oriented to a future. Hence, Edelman's infamous analysis that queer choices disrupt lineage, leaving no future. Queer sexualities are suspect not only because they do not necessarily lead to children, but also because they may give rise to non-normative logics and organizations of community, sexual identity, embodiment, and activity in space and time. There's clearly a very interesting conversation between the notion of the temporality and slow violence and the kind of temporal disruption that I'm talking about. And I would, you know, sort of thinking in response to your talk, I would say there needs to be an uncoupling of slowness or generationality from the insistence that it is a kind of a reproductive generationality. That's my answer to the question that I assume someone will ask me. Anderson considers that a queer critique of this repronormative conception of time. Anderson considers that a queer critique of this repronormative conception of time and space may also cultivate a position of queer environmental critique. Using Christopher Isherwood's A Single Man, she argues that the novel turns repronormativity on its head by staging heterosexual futurity as a sort of apocalypse. A sense of the future always already oriented to breeding and to generational continuity sacrifices the multiple possibilities of the present in favor of an always deferred, always defined future. And in so doing, also justifies the plundering of resources and the devastation of spaces as part of a heteronatural logic of proliferation. Isherwood himself is directly critical of post-war fecundity, both of babies and of goods, which he sees as inextricably tied, writes Anderson. The destruction of the environment directly correlates to the production of children. Isherwood infuses the heterosexual act with the power to create a generalized apocalypse, wiping away all life on the planet. At the same time, though, heterosex, in the novel, is entirely stripped of any eroticism, making heterosexual acts purely reproductive and not pleasurable in any way, the epitome of futurity, delayed gratification. Isherwood is also preoccupied with the creation of queer space that overturns heterosexism and homophobia in order to open up queer erotic possibility, establish zones of safety for queerness, and expose ecological destruction, particularly through production and consumption. Although I would definitely want us to avoid any simplistic treatment of the relationship between population and environmental destruction, I would maintain, with Isherwood and with Anderson, that the organization of post-war North American suburbs to facilitate repronormative time and space, for example, certainly offers up an important opening for queer ecological critique. Such a critique might begin in queer subcultures that produce alternative temporalities by allowing their participants to believe that their futures can be imagined according to logics that lie outside of those paradigmatic markers of life experience, namely birth, marriage, reproduction, and death. And I have, I confess, long since wondered why queer sex options are not part of liberal feminist discourses of women's empowerment and birth control in so-called what I have previously called reproductive structural adjustment programs in developing countries. Erickson, finally, considers that this same complex of repronormative temporal and spatial relations, also linked in his argument to the modern conception of the nation, is tied to what Winnubst calls a future anterior, an anticipation of a future state that establishes the present as a realm of utility, a sacrifice zone, if you will, for that which is not yet. If the future is the goal and the present is understood as a condition of what will have been the future anterior, then what is, however horrific, becomes justifiable in light of its necessity in bringing about this already given future. Queer experiences indicate a politics without a future and thus demand an uncoupling of the present from this future anterior. According to Erickson, then, thinking through a politics of nature without a future means rethinking nature such that it is not bent always already toward the utility of power. Opening ourselves to the possibilities of history means addressing the ways in which the ideologies and concrete practices that have formed out of current understandings of nature represent more about desired human outcomes than they do about anything non-human. What a difference a queer day makes. What kinds of radical ecological possibilities are opened when, from a queer perspective, we think beyond saving the earth for future generations, beyond the eventuality of apocalypse, beyond the bourgeois progressivism that establishes the environmentalist's present as the modern and enlightened outcome of other necessary, generally violent and unpleasant pasts. There are, of course, many other examples of work in this queer ecopolitical vein in which particular elements of experience, thought, culture, and history give rise to different kinds of ecopolitical engagement. But then there's also the work of Diane Chisholm, whose considerations of the queer nature writing of Ellen Milloy via both Deleuze and E.O. Wilson rather nicely complicates the distinction I've just drawn between queer nature and queer episteme. And then there are also writers like Halberstam and Noel Sturgeon, who both write about the spectacular insertion of non-human sexualities, they're both especially into penguins, into largely heteronormative popular culture, with specific, deeply political effects on both queer humans and others. I thus recognize that I'm on pretty dangerous ice by clumping nascent queer ecologies into these two divergent tendencies. I don't want to create a schism where none actually exists. I don't want to reinscribe profoundly humanist boundaries around the political and the notions of experience and episteme that I am arguing always situate politics. And I don't want to discount the inordinate political value of simply thinking the other and the self differently. Still, I want to defend my analytic choice on pedagogical grounds. emphasizing that there are at least two different constellations in the articulation of queer with ecology, highlights the fact that there is something like a co-constitutive relationship between them. On the one hand, a politicized rendering of queer thinking about nature in the context of heteronormative relations, and on the other, a radically expanded understanding of the more than human world from which to challenge the biopolitical relations through which heteronormativity is at least partly established. Recognizing that there are two groups of voices in this conversation allows us perhaps to carry it out a bit more effectively. In this context, one might argue that literature has a special role to play in developing this conversation between two positions. Recall Morton's suggestion that queer literary forms might do a better job of representing queer nature than does masculinist nature writing. Perhaps with the addition of Stein et al.'s insights on situation, queer ecological literature and criticism can also begin from a position of historic particularity to ask the reader to queer her eco-perspective. Eco-perceptive position to consider the possibilities of a queer nature in a specifically queer manner. Unthinking heteronaturativity might then usefully begin in something like the idea of a queer aesthetics that I raised earlier. How might we borrow something like a highly cultivated queer camp aesthetic involving excess, public sexual invocation, and overt expressions of queer desire to open up an understanding of the world that, in defying heteronormative convention, reveals something of the experience of estrangeness that is always already excessive to those conventions? I know how short we are of time, so I'd just like you to, briefly introduce you and strongly encourage you to rush out and read the book Sirius Begins at Night, published in 1996 by Trinidadian-Canadian author Shani Mutu. Sirius Blooms at Night is set on a fictional Caribbean island called Are people familiar with this book? Some. The fictional Caribbean island of Lantana Camara, interestingly, the only place in the novel that actually figures with its own name is Canada. One of the characters goes there. And the story is actually a marvelous rewriting of kind of a neo-pastoral rendering of the tropics, in which there is, you know, sort of lush greenery and exoticized feminine sexuality all in one package that is routinely sold via Sunquest tours, as much as it was, you know, sort of part of earlier generations of romantic travel literature. So the book is both queer and strongly post-colonial. It is a story of there's one primary relationship in the text, and that is between a gay male nurse named Tyler and his charge, who is the village witch, a crazy lady named Mala. And Mala, at the beginning of the novel, is actually nonverbal, except as Tyler discovers, she has developed in the context of years of self-imposed exile after murdering her father, an extraordinary ability to actually understand and speak with members of other species. So she does these elaborate bird calls. That's actually the first instance of speech that we have from her, is that she perfectly... I can't remember the species of bird, but she does a perfect response to a bird call. People in writing about it tend to call them mimicry and imitation. I don't think that's actually true. I think she's responding to a nonverbal or a non-human verbal language. In any case, what we have going on in the novel is a wonderful mixing and meshing of modes of naturalization and modes of denaturalization. And the aesthetic effect of the text is this wonderful combination of lushness and disgust. None of the characters, although there's a wonderful sort of celebratory possibility, and it is a very queer celebratory possibility. In fact, if there is a Garden of Eden, it is established in a lesbian relationship in the early part of the text, in the early part of the novel. But all of these sort of lush, accurate botanical descriptions all have some sense of rot and decay. The island is permeated with this great sexual possibility and also homophobia. The island has all of this glorious tendency toward beauty, particularly as exemplified in the figure of the knight blooming Sirius of the novel's title. And yet it is also absolutely racked by colonial violence, and particularly by sexual violence. All of the characters are queered. There is an affinity among the characters because they are queered, and in fact Mutu actually more or less says that, or in the form of Tyler, actually says that this is the basis on which the affinity occurs. Mala never really speaks. She does sing, but all of the actual words through which her story appears to the reader are Tyler's. So we presume this relationship of queer affinity, which authorizes his speech. But there is this wonderful disruptive excess ties together the absolutely extraordinarily, ecstatically beautiful with the really revolting. And that kind of excess is used over and over and over again to bodily remind the reader of colonial violence, of sexual violence, and of the possibilities of affinity that emerge in the wake of those violences. So I'd just like to end by reading you one piece that actually shows you one instance of that of that kind of combination, and also the botanical accuracy with which Mutu is rendering it. It's an imaginary place, but it is a real place. This is a scene that takes place once Mala has withdrawn from engagement with the world. Mala's companions were the garden's birds, insects, snails, and reptiles. She and they and the abundant foliage gossiped among themselves. She listened intently. With an ear pressed to the ground, she heard ant communities building, transporting food, and breeding. She listened to worms coiling arduously from place to place. She knelt on the ground and whispered to the grass and other young plants, encouraging them to grow. And then she listened as they stretched up to her. She did not intervene in nature's business. When it came time for one creature to succumb to another, she retreated. Flora and fauna left her to her own devices, and in return she left them to theirs. At first, Aves, Hexapoda, Gastropoda, and Reptilia burrowed instinctively into nooks and crevices. They realized eventually that they had no cause to hide. Mala permitted them to roam boldly and to multiply at leisure throughout her property. She provided, there's this sort of exuberant generativity of this non-human-human relationship. She provided them one service. Every season, she rummaged through the yard for carcasses of those fallen prey to natural causes, and with ritual grace, she facilitated an honorable disposal. She noted the position of the sun. When it reached a particular spot on the horizon, she would finish her collecting for the season. Before that day, she routinely descended the back stairs with a bucket in one hand. One morning, she came upon a shiny honey-brown beetle. Her heart soared, and she reached into the pocket of her flower pince dress for the item she had once called tweezers. Before she made it to the foot of the stairs, she had plucked carcasses of a bashak, a spinner ant, two red ants, and a black-red cockroach as long as her thumb. She placed them gingerly in the bucket. By the time she picked every visible corpse off her property, the heap included ants, beetles, cockroaches, different kinds of spiders, some bees, flies, a wasp, two fetid lizard skins, and the brittle remains of their skeletons, six butterflies, a stick insect the length of her forearm, two dragonflies, a handful of crickets, and other creatures that in the world of naming remain untitled. The collection measured a full hand deep. She paid no attention to the odor arising out of the bucket. The scent of decay was not offensive to her. It was the aroma of life refusing to end. It was the aroma of transformation. Such odor was proof that nothing truly ended. And she reveled in it as much as she did the fragrance of the Sirius blossoms along the back wall of the house. And I'll end there. Thank you.
Unfortunately, Sara Perryman was scheduled to be Kate's respondent, is ill and has not been able to make it to the conference. So, okay, right now, so I'm resisting the temptation. So initially the idea is that I was going to do it, but I think in the interesting of time, we'll open to question and answers. And I'm, my reading and my interest in Kate's work is very supportive, but at the end may not be something that will make her a favor. From what I'm reading, every time she reads literature that is coming from a very specific historical experience of queer and how that involves, how translates into a different experience of the wilderness, I find models for how to read the books I usually read in my corpus, including the work that you are offering now. And in the past has been narratives of loss and narratives of loss in the city as people move from the city into the wilderness, and how coming from those narratives of loss has affected in different way the perception of wilderness. You have mentioned today narrative in where there are no future or no nature with capital N, which are stories that are. So this is the part where I think maybe I'm not making you a favor, because this seems to be stories that take place also in other genres that are not necessarily coming from queer. And I'm afraid by doing so, I'm not also contributing to your fear that if everything becomes queer, if queer becomes a name of some sort of grammar in which we can read certain narratives, then queer becomes everything and at the same time becomes nothing. And there is a lot in Kate's argument that it is about revisiting the idea of queer. So I don't want to take, maybe I shouldn't be taking the discussion further to that side and centralize it on the core of that proposal about revisiting the notion of queer from everything that is coming from the sciences and the possibility of a queer epistemology. So we are ready for questions and answers. I suppose there are going to be a lot.
More than a question, is a comment. I noticed that the cinema in Canada is rich and very interesting in many ways. So, in particularly connected with your talk, what is going on in the cinema that can give you some hints that also in cinema you can find images of what you are talking about?
There's a very active queer film industry in Canada. Probably the most among the most famous would be John Grayson and Guy Madden, and especially Deepa Mehta, whose trilogy Fire, Earth, Water. Is that the right order? Yes. Explores in a variety of very interesting ways. That I think actually, perhaps most obviously in water, some of the ways in which the landscape, in this case the Ganges, supports, sustains, and creates communities. In this case, of widows. But it is more, that's more indirect. One of the reasons why I choose Mutu is because she isn't just making a nice landscape for the enactment of queer drama. The landscape is the queer drama. It is part of the queer drama. Another fictional work that I would also recommend in which nature is extremely active is a novel called Saltfish Girl by Larissa Lai, which is a work of also. Mutu was originally from, when she was writing Serious Blues at Night, lived in Vancouver. Lai is also from Vancouver. It's set in the Pacific Northwest at an unspecified time in the future, and reproduction suddenly starts to take place through genetically modified organisms, which creates all kinds of queer possibilities for non-heteronormative couplings. So it's vastly dystopian and very queer at the same time. I'm better on books than I am at film.
Eric, I enjoyed your talk. I found it extremely provocative. Got me thinking about the project of bringing ecology and queer theory together, just how perhaps always already overdetermined that connection is. From a more history of science, of Kangi and Foucault, history of science direction, I was thinking about the history of taxonomy as something that's certainly been common to both the history of biology and the history of, well, when sexual diversity is understood as it's already a biological diversity taxonomic model. I was just wondering about precisely the ways in which some people in the psychoanalytic dimension here about resisting nature whatever sexuality is for psychoanalysis, it's not natural. It doesn't look for correlates in a world that would be non-human. So I'm just wondering more about the question of taxonomy.
I think that is one of the risks of Myra Hurd's work in particular. I think it opens a gloriously interesting can of worms, and therefore I think go for it. But it very much does open this whole question: what work is it that I am doing by actually saying that there is this sort of obvious relationship between sexual and biological diversity? I don't mean to plug my recent book, but there is a brilliant article by Liddell McWhorter in that book precisely about the problem of that particular linkage. In fact, politically, the notion of sexual diversity has routinely been naturalized by recourse to an understanding of biological diversity. So I think although it's really quite interesting to imagine the ways, because you know, Hurd really does say, all right, think about sex from the perspective of a barnacle. That I think is interesting. The mere use of a notion of natural diversity as a way of justifying the existence of a range of sexual diversities is actually more troubling. The taxonomic production of sexualities as inverts and onanists and pederasts and all of that stuff. It happened in the late 19th century. I would argue not coincidentally at the same time as other kinds of taxonomic categories came into being. So I would be loath to simply say what we need are better categories. I would say, are there ways in which this understanding of queer nature can actually be used to more critically, not simply to naturalize diversity, but also to call into question the kinds of categories through which we have enumerated diversity in the first place. I think the question about whether psychoanalysis considers sexuality, any kind of sexuality, to be natural or unnatural, really depends on which psychoanalyst you're working with. One of my very close friends is a Kleinian, and she struggles with the psychoanalytic establishment on a regular basis. About trans, and it is there is still a legacy in clinical psychoanalytic practice that pathologizes the trans as yet a failed gender identification in the midst of what is yet to be understood as what is yet understood as a natural progression of sexuality toward certain kinds of identificatory ends.
I want to thank you for your presentation, and actually my question will come continue with what you mentioned at the end of your answer that has to do with how to incorporate trans studies particularly.
Could you say that
again? How to incorporate trans studies to the same kind of questions that you're presenting, particularly because of the work that is done in intervention against nature in a certain way. No? And so my question to simplify it would be, how would you imagine a trans ecology, right?
I wish I had my grad student here who's writing her thesis on that topic. But I've learned a little bit from her. One of the other interesting things that, I'm going to speak about her one more time. One of the really interesting things that she raises is the fact that one of the arguments about authenticity that has been used as a way of singularizing trans as a phenomenon is saying that, or human trans as a phenomenon, is saying that we are the only species that has the capacity to actually technologically change its sex. And her investigation shows that that's not especially the case. You have to actually employ a pretty narrow understanding of what constitutes a technology in order to make the case of human exceptionalism. So, yet another human-non-human boundary falls down. What is interesting is the way, because there's some really interesting sort of eco-trans things going on. There is even in popular culture, there's a series that was narrated by Isabella Rossellini, in which there's this sort of this glorious erotic. I mean,
green
this is
porn.
What
green porn.
Green porn. Thank you. This is what I don't want to do. I like Isabella Rossellini, but I don't want to do this. This is just sort of this sort of ludic celebration of all things sexual. And isn't this fun? Isn't this strange? Isn't this queer? Without any sort of critical sense of yes, but what is this doing to us? So not simply a process of naturalization. You've got that kind of trans ecology going on in popular culture. Another really interesting one is a community of very committed, it's an organization that you'll find on the website called Trans Advocate. And this is an organization that is committed to the idea that human trans is the result of endocrine disruption. So that there's a large number of people who actually hold to the idea that trans is a product of nature, but it's a product of a deeply flawed nature. So trans is an environmental disaster in that case. I think the jury is out on that particular case. I think there are ways in which this other sort of trans literature is helpful as a way of saying, as a way of countering that kind of naturalized pathologizing argument. I think perhaps a trans ecology would. I like the idea of imagining from a place of serial sexuality. Imagining away from, beginning with a trans experience to, or a kind of trans narrative that would imagine kind of Orlando-like, there's a perfect example, how over the course of time one's relationship to nature might actually change as a result of different kind of embodied, gendered, within the course of a lifespan, embodied and gendered responses to the natural world. So Orlando goes from, I'm not sure if you remember, but this climate change happens in Orlando. It's one of the things that I want to do at some point is write about this book as a novel of climate change. Orlando's bodily relationship to the world changes as his gender changes, and that's something that's really quite interesting to explore. So in that moment of becoming other, how do we learn something? Eli Clare would be someone else that I would recommend. Exile and Pride was his first book.
Thank you for your talk. I was wondering, since you're interested in pop culture themes, whether you had thought about this part in Jurassic Park, where the premise is that they've created only female dinosaurs on the island, thinking that they can't reproduce since they're all female. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, that doesn't work out. And they expression when they discover that they've been reproducing is, I think...
parthenogenetically.
Yeah, but I think that Jeff Goldblum's character says, nature always finds a way. And it's like this... but I think it's an interesting commentary if you, in the context of the whole narrative, that there's this scientific, rationalist, capitalist, male-dominated field coming in, taking over this island, and creating something that it conceives as being impotent because it's all female. And then once it finds a way to transform itself into part male, part female, then the danger comes. And I was wondering if that, how that whole scenario might fit in with some of the things that you're interested in terms of naturalizing heteronormativity.
I have to make a confession that because of my own imbrication in repro time, my watching of movies like Jurassic Park had not yet come into being when Jurassic Park, my daughter's 14, so I never saw Jurassic Park. I'm not able to understand that question from deep awareness of it, and I guess I have to go watch it now. But I think there, you know, the idea that there is this sort of the assumption that nature, that an all-female nature is sterile, and the idea that nature, you know, that woman nature, unpredictable, evil, manages to find a way, is not uncommon in popular culture. Like nature, a feminized nature frequently exceeds the bounds of male rational attempts to subdue it.
Break for lunch.
No further questions.
Break for lunch.
Okay.